Hi, this is Dr. Lisa from the Dr. Lisa Soul Senti podcast, and today we're talking about my new edition of my book that came out, our second edition, and we added new strategies. I'm super, super excited about this book. It's helped so many hundreds and hundreds of kids and families and teachers. This book I'm really super proud of. I actually wrote this book in 2013, so on the 10-year anniversary, we're celebrating it. We actually got the second edition out. So the first edition came out in 2013. And you may have listened to my other podcasts. If you didn't, I'll summarize this real quickly. There's a podcast before this one that gets into the book in more depth. So if you didn't listen to that one, please go back and listen to it, because I don't want you to listen to this podcast thinking I'm skipping over some really good things about the book. But this is the part two of the part one podcast. So really quickly, I wrote this book because my son was having a hellacious time with school when he was younger. And as I was going through it, trying to figure out how to create a classroom that would work for him, there were kids coming up that were younger than him. And these teachers that were working with me, because this book is a collaboration of my work and research and my really, really hard work for Luke, helping him, but also amazing special education teachers that came up with these ideas of how to help him and share it with me. And also Luke figuring things out and, you know, therapists helping me and just my friends. And I have to say some general education teachers too. I found that to be just a very difficult thing for them, because they have such a big classroom with so many kids and they don't have the support system. So once we got them into special education and we set up the class, first of all, the one thing I do talk about is if you're looking at three classrooms, each classroom's different. So there's three or four different types of settings or classrooms you can put your child in. And then once they're in that classroom and you choose it, and you believe it or not, it might not work, you can move the child between the classrooms. It's actually called mainstream, and you can move them through these different types of academic settings. But you're going to have a support system, you're going to have services, you're going to have modifications, adaptive strategies. You're going to have all these things you're going to have this toolbox with this child that can move between the classrooms. That really helps the general education teacher. So they also are a big, big part of it, but it's limited with them. You can't expect, and that's one of the things the book's talking about, is you can't put your kid in a big classroom and there's 27 kids there and your kid's struggling neurologically. And neurologically can be emotionally, it can be behaviorally, it can be with motor skills, fine or gross motor skills. It could be with, you know, sight, sound, smell, touch. It could be emotionally, it can also be socially. It also could be like physically with writing. It could be sensory, anxiety, ADD, ADHD, focus, all these things. I mean, there's just so many things. So that's that. That being said, his journey was hellacious. And so as we were figuring this all out as a team, as together, and believe me, you do have to fire people on your team too. That's talked about in the book. You cannot keep the people who aren't for you or for your child. You just have to get rid of it. You have to stand in between. There was mothers struggling behind me and fathers with their kids and teachers, and teachers would defer them to me. And they would be like, you know, you have to talk to Mrs. Solcenti. You have to go see Dr. Solcenti in her office, because I was doing a lot of advocacy back then. I was going into meetings. I was going into child study teams. I was helping people write 504s, all these things. We were setting up IRSs, and I didn't know any of this. I came out of college with a neurology degree, a nutrition degree, chiropractic degree. And I'm like, what? And I really just thought the education system knew their stuff. I was like, okay, you're calling me every single day asking me to pick Luke up early. And I'm asking you, what are we going to do about this? And you're like, I don't know. What do you want to do? Literally, that was the answer every single day from teachers. Help. They just call me. And what they do is they call you and they tell you what your son did wrong. I love the principals. They just call you and pretty much just tell you what your kid did wrong, or tell you that your kid's in trouble, or, you know, what are the demerits, or what are the detentions, or what's the land of no neighbors, or whatever the heck. And they just tell you constantly what your kid did wrong. They don't have a solution for it. That was what I was finding in my world. That I was like, what are we going to do? So I remember one day I sat down with the principal and I was like, what do you want me to do? He's already punished. Like, what? This isn't working. Like, I punish him, you call me. And that's what I learned. Like, if I got in trouble at school, my dad punished me and that was it. And we we didn't do it again because you didn't want to get in trouble. Or sometimes you did it again, you got in trouble again. You had to like weigh the risk out here. But you get it, right? And I was just getting calls every single day. And finally I sat down, I was like, what is it that you want me to do? You're the educator. You're the one that's getting paid big money to oversee your teachers and classrooms and curriculums, and you're the one that's supposed to have the background in education. You, I think, would have your master's, right? Some of you have your PhDs, and you are seriously have nothing to offer to me. So that was the problem. That's why the book's written, because once we were figuring things out as a team, I don't just say it was all me. And once things were working for Luke, once things were clicking, the phenomenal part was people were coming to me. Even guidance counselors were sending them or giving them my book. I saw this on so many guidance counselors' desks. It was so exciting to just see. I mean, I'm not in schools anymore because my kids are, 19 and up, and just to see my book be a part of changing lives is just so exciting. Really, it just brings a smile to my face, warms my heart. So I wrote the book so it could be handed to other moms. So I couldn't answer as many emails. I couldn't be in meetings anymore. My nutrition practice started taking off. That's a whole nother realm of how we help Luke. I think I mentioned it in the first podcast, but I didn't get into it. The crux of helping Luke was helping his gut. I have to say, that's really the main thing. I don't talk about this in this book. It's probably going to come out in a second book at some point. Or I'll add it to the third edition. But really, the part I found was we did all these therapies with Luke. You're going to see that. We're going to talk about these strategies because the first part of the book the first part of the book, and I lightly went over the second half, and now I want to jump into the second half. But what you need to know is all these strategies that we did and all these therapies that we did. So if you're doing speech therapy, if you're doing behavioral therapy, if you're doing anger management, if you're doing social skills, if you're doing PT, OT, chiropractic, acupuncture, all that stuff, really honestly, a lot of it doesn't really take off and really help the child until the gut is healed. I think chiropractic is the second thing because that really works with charting that nervous system and keeping the nervous system balanced. So the very first thing was always chiropractic with me, but as I dug into the gut-brain connection, I realized the most important piece to the whole entire puzzle is the gut. And if you don't have that gut balance, if you have your child has a leaky gut, if your child has a poor gut microbiome, if the child has the gut pathogen in there, if they don't have the amino acids, if their gut is leaky, if they don't have the vitamins and the nutrients, they aren't going to have a brain that can handle turning on and off when the teacher wants it to. And I talk about this overstimulated, over-tilted nervous system. That's the child. We always look at the child. I always put a picture up of a brain with a spine. And I'm like, that's what we're talking about right here. When you're scolding and when you're frustrated, that's what you're frustrated with, because that brain is a computer within the child and it is controlling the child. The child is fighting it and trying to turn it off and calm it down. And when the teacher wants it to. But the problem is, and I talk about this all in the book and I explain it to the teachers, like the child can come from the playground and then you want them to sit down and be calm and open up their math books. And if this child's nervous system is still on, right, the light switch is still on, it's on this gone on energy, this fight or flight energy, the child can't always just turn it off. So the child's sitting there at the desk, maybe tapping the desk, flipping the chair, roaming and walking around the classroom, and the teacher's getting frustrated. A general education teacher, of course, is going to get frustrated because they just have a big classroom and they have to move on. The special education teacher knows what to do with this child. I don't know how the principal doesn't ever figure this out. Believe me, I'm frustrated with principals for the rest of my life. Like, it's one of the most, I hate to say it, if you're a principal, and if you are, please read my book, because I had a principal read it and I heard her say in the hallway, we need to change things. She went to one of my lectures and I heard her say, she didn't know I heard her. She goes, we need to really change things up. We're doing things drastically and devastatedly wrong. This is one of the best seminars I've ever heard, because I bring it in the brain. I bring it about the nervous system. I teach them it. It's not the child's fault. They're not going to school to be belligerent. They're just not. They're not going in there to be in the principal's office. So I talk about all this stuff. And you can listen to the first podcast, because I want to jump into the second half of the book when we talk about some of the things you can do. And I'm not going to read the book to you, so you're going to have to read the book. And I'd love for you to buy the book for people who are struggling, because this book has changed lives. I talk about a day in the life of a child. We go through the whole day and how they fail to produce academically, emotionally, and socially in areas of behavior because of their disability, that they are not misbehaving on purpose. And actually, these children usually have high IQs, and they're commonly withheld from a lot of opportunities and services that special education can offer them, or maybe a 504. And because they'll just turn them away because they're smart. And they need to learn how to identify when they're overwhelmed. The child needs to learn how to advocate for themselves, to communicate, and all maybe remove themselves if necessary. So this is part of teaching the child too, to notice like, hey, I realize that my nervous system's off right now. I need to speak up. And it's imperative that our classrooms adapt this preventative styles of teaching so the over-tilted child can learn coping skills necessary to be at the same playing field and succeed at the same level as their peers do. So my purpose is to help you, your child, the teacher, create a classroom that focuses on teaching through the disability using adaptive teaching methods in a preventative manner. And that's what this book is really, really all about. So we go through the whole day so you understand how overwhelming, how busy, how the sounds, the smells, all the people, the anxiety builds up through the days. So I want you to really understand the child's day. And then we go into these classrooms of the future that I just absolutely love. And I do wish that there'd be a one principal that would make all their teachers read this book and start implementing things from this book into the classrooms. And they would be on a program that they all are working on. And they figure it out, right? And they start changing these classrooms, because the classrooms of today are just destructive and harmful to a child. And I strongly believe that. The Sensational Classroom is bridging, it's one classroom where we bridge the gap between the parent, teacher, and child. So they're all working together to create a sensational classroom. So one that focuses that the teacher can teach through a disability by embracing the disability and using adaptive preventative style teaching methods. I want teachers to be capable of identifying triggers that can cause poor behaviors and teach through them. A preventative style means grabbing and owning the idea that the poor behavior, and again, the behavior could be poor focus, it could be anxiety, depression. It could be it could be they're not doing their work. It could be poor academic performance. They want to understand that it may be due to their disability and not done on purpose. A preventative style also requires compassion for the over-tilted child's family, embracing them and working towards creating a classroom environment that rolls with the punches, right? It rolls with the flow. It prevents poor behavior and removes reason for anxiety. It's magically anticipating what can happen next, right? You're helping the child overcome that fear of what's going to happen next, right? So you're going to ask yourself all these questions. You have to say, why? Why is the child behaving or responding inappropriately? How is the child supposed to meet all the needs and focus on body, mind, and spirit? Is the child overwhelmed, worried, fearful, right? You can do this. You can overcome this. So the second half of the book comes up with some innovative ideas shared by, again, professionals, teachers, and parents, and myself on a unified mission to transform the lives of these over-tilted children. We're creating preventative-styled adaptive strategies. That's what these are called. And no two over-tilted kids are the same, so you really have to work it with this and roll with it. So we have one called The Resort. I love this one. It's a way to create a go-to place with the within the classroom. So what we found is if a child, there's some children that you got to teach the child to be able to recognize their own energy starting to come up. So we can call it an anxiety, but a lot of it could be sensory too. It could just be this. So we call it an energy, right? So it's an on energy. We talk about a light switch. You could also talk about a fan, where the normal energy would be just a fan, you know, slowly spinning. And when the fan spins faster and faster, or the light switch is on, this means his energy is coming up, and the child needs to learn that feeling of this energy being on. And some children might benefit having a place to go to. And sometimes it's best to have it in the room when they're young. When they're older, this probably wouldn't work because it would be embarrassing. But we talk about some ideas of what this little resort, we call it the resort, and it's in the back of the room. And we talk about what it would look like, how you could, what you could put there. You know, you could use a little chair and you can have some sensory toys there. And we talk about what that looks like and how you would use it. There's also, some people call it a relaxation station, and that's another place that they can go to so their nervous system settles. So if, let's say, you came in from the playground, the teacher wants them to take out their book, the child just can't do it, the child's all over the place and is not focused, and the teacher can maybe put the child in the relaxation station. We talk about this. It's actually great at the elementary. You can still use it at the middle school area. We talk about the differences here. Sometimes it's a beanbag chair with some books, a squeeze ball, some little things that are there to help them overcome it. A beanbag is great because it provides pressure and reduces stimulation. You might have some rules, you know, on how they have to use these stations or these go-to places, but I really explain it here in the book. And the whole idea is just to give the body the time to unwind, to turn off, for the fan to slow down, for the light switch to turn off. You can't expect the brain to turn off when you want it to, and that's what this is really about. We talk about the fidget toys, the clay and putties, some things that they could do to keep busy. Sometimes they can stay at their desk, and if they have a fidget toy or they have something, it allows that energy to have somewhere to go. So sometimes it's about taking this energy that they feel and just giving them something to do. So if they're like fidgeting, they're playing with a toy, they're playing with some clay, believe it or not, they can do a whole, my son could do a whole math lesson hanging upside down on a chair. He really can. As long, you could put Play-Doh on his desk and let him play, and he will learn the whole lesson. He'll hear it because he was very, very auditory. But what we had to do sometimes is get that energy directed somewhere else, you know. So fidget toys can allow the child's desk, you know, to keep the child to be seated at the desk, right? But in middle school, you could be too embarrassed playing with fidget toys, right? Or clay or anything like that. So you could do things like, you're stating that you want to keep them at their desk. They're not going to go to a separate area in the room. They're not going to play with toys. So we talk about what you can do for staying seated at the desk, but letting that energy go and not using a toy. We talk about Velcro and what you can do with Velcro, and things on the seat and stuff like that, that they could rub, and things that they can do quietly so other kids can't see it. We talk about running an errand. I'm not going to go over all these things. Sometimes running an errand can be great, and sometimes it can really backfire. So I talk about the pros and cons of running an errand. We talk about passwords and secret passes. Again, part of this one is really teaching the child that they need to leave the room. They just need to kind of go unwind. And so they're going to have to start recognizing and advocating for themselves. Then the teacher responds. They're not afraid of it. They know the teacher is going to let them have their little pass. And it could be a cool down card or a little password that they have to say so that they can go. They might, basically what this is saying is, and it could be, I have to go to the bathroom. It could be something like that. And they need a break outside the classroom is what they're saying. So you could have them run an errand, but you have to be very careful that backfires. You can't have them walk the halls, right? So you might have to give them an errand to go do something. Also, there could be a sensory room at the guidance counselor's office so that, that they can go there. We talk about having a go-to person. We had that too when things were really just, the child really needed to leave the room because it was overstimulating. There was a go-to person. So it could be the secretary. It could be the guidance counselor. It could be, I say the secretary because sometimes the guidance counselor is not there. I found that to be a huge problem a lot, that like he would go there and nobody else would know, and that's stupid too. That has to be in the plan. And I don't know how your whole guidance counselor department wouldn't be using the same thing. It blows my mind that a child will go there, and just because their guidance counselor is not there, the other ones are like, I don't really know why you're here. So that's stupid too. We see what I'm saying? Like, it's just not set up right. So maybe it's the secretary at the guidance counselor understands all these kids that are on this plan, and this is what we do. We put them in a little sensory room, or they just need to chill out. They just need that energy, that brain, to turn off. And then when it does, they're ready to go back. But these can be abused by kids too. They learn manipulative behaviors, and teachers use these incorrectly. So I go over all this in the book. We had a teacher for Luke. It was a nightmare. I didn't know what was going on. It was so bad. And then when his behavior's bad, one thing when you keep getting something from a teacher or a principal, that the child keeps doing over and over and over again, please investigate it. Dig deep, because sometimes you're going to find a pattern amongst the adults that the child is either, maybe the child's manipulating it, but the pattern was created by the adults. They kind of are enablers. I'm going to give you a quick example, is and I apologize if she's listening, but this was going on and this was just insane. The music teacher didn't like Luke, and really honestly, because Luke was disruptive in her music class. And this was a place where, again, you're doing recorders, you're doing instruments. His energy is just now going to go on. Now it's stimulating. So he's just being overstimulated by this input of sound, right? And one of his major issues, Luke's diagnosis was severe sensory processing disorder. But the music teacher and the principal and the guidance counselor, you know, nobody really didn't put that together, you know, that one of the, think about it. If you go into the music room right now and all those kids were playing instruments, you would be like, oh my gosh, you would be cringing, right? So she would just send him out. She would just send him to the principal's office. And he would go to the principal's office and I guess sometimes just walk around the school or, you know, go to the principal's office and get there. And then when he went to the principal's office, the principal put a desk in his office where he would just sit and then be disruptive to the principal. So it was just crazy because it would just snowball where nobody was really dealing with the problem at hand. So sometimes I had Luke just walking around the school and sometimes I had Luke at the principal's office just sitting at a desk being disruptive and getting in trouble. So I realized it when the principal kept calling me and telling me he was being disruptive. And then I asked around and I found out, oh, he spends the whole music lesson with the principal and then he's disruptive to the principal. Like, I didn't even know what was going on. It was just so dumb. It was just so dumb, but the adults were causing it. I mean, it was like, you just aren't really setting up adaptive strategies to help Luke deal with the music teacher. You're allowing Luke to just Luke learned, if I misbehave, I get to leave, right? And the teacher just learned, I'm just getting rid of this kid. I'm not dealing with him. It was poor all around, everyone involved. So that's what I'm talking about. We talk about technology and how 10 years ago, we didn't really have much technology. So now this might sound silly, but you can use computers and keyboards and iPods and iPads and laptops and academic software programs to really create a successful classroom. And the really, really technology today really helps the nervous system keep busy. It motivates children to learn. It's an amazing portion that you can look at. Academic problems such as delay in writing, reading, and math are also solved with keyboards and computers. If they can't write, I know a lot of times Luke couldn't write out, like, you know, big reports and stuff like that. We were like, can he type it? This might sound silly, but this is something that they wouldn't allow back then. And I'm not too sure where they are today, but still you can still consider integrating technology. And I get into definitely help them with fine motor. You don't have to force them to do something that they're just not neurologically ready to do yet. And that's my big part about the technology section, is that, you know, just because a first grader or second grader is really my son was 2 years behind fine motor writing. So that's writing, right? Getting, and then they have higher functioning problems with the frontal part of their brain where they can't get the thought from their brain to their hand, and then they can't get the hand to actually write out that thought. So that's a huge thing, and you have to be aware that that's just a delayed neurological thing, and so you can't force it. So we talk about different ways of getting around that, even giving book reports and stuff like that. We talk about that, you know, a 5-page paper. Are they unwilling to do it? Can they not do that? Can we break that task down reasonably? We talk about breaking things down. We talk about doing oral book reports and getting in front of the classroom and taking a step back and allowing yourself to really say, what is going on? Why is the child unwilling to do this? Why can't the child do it? What is going on here? We talk about move and groove learning and testing. We talk about science and math. Can it be more hands-on and messy? Can we have more hands-on projects? Is the problem really these rote dittos? Are you handing out dittos? Are you one of those people that, you know, the math questions are all on dittos? Really, really read into this. We talk about using wiki sticks. We have a system called Gotcha, which I think every single school should implement and every single teacher should be doing it. The principal should be in charge. I think it would change the whole landscape of bullying and the way we treat each other. This comes from a friend. Their school did it in Maryland, and it's a great, great system for character building, strengthening positive behaviors. You're focusing on the good behaviors that you want. You're rewarding the good behaviors. I talk about that whole aspect in the reward system, is that you want to reward good behavior and stop punishing for bad behavior. If you keep focusing on the negative behavior, that's what you're going to get. We talk about leadership, putting these kids in leadership roles. I talk about schedules. It's really, really, really important to take away that anxiety of what's going to happen next, what is going on now, and what will happen next. And you want to provide clear cues as to what the class is doing now, when you're about to end it, and when you're going to transition to the next thing. Those three things right there create so much anxiety for some children, and you're going to turn on that fight or flight. You're going to turn on that brain. Once the anxiety kicks in, they really can't control what their brain's going to do. So you have to help them settle it down, that energy. If the child has a speech at 11 a.m., a lunch at 12:15, a schedule that you put in front of them, they can mindfully be ready, right? Be ready in the mind. That's what we talk about. We don't know what the mind's going to do, because the mind can go somewhere to just being, oh my gosh, I don't understand what's going on. And I don't know, the brain just starts wandering and they get anxious, right? And they just get upset. 5-minute warnings. We talk about all that stuff. What's going to happen next? We talk about bins, binders, and books and homework. That could be a pulling your hair out arena for parent, teacher, and child. I hated this area. He was always in trouble for not bringing home homework or bringing homework to school. First of all, the first problem was it wouldn't come home. Then when I finally got it to come home, I made sure he did it. I watched him do it. And then I made him put it in the book bag. And then the book bag went right by the door. So it was never forgotten. And then when it got to school, she would just always be like, he didn't bring it in. And I was like, well, where did it go? I mean, and what I realized is there was no support system on the other end. So again, these teachers expect you to be full support at home. Support me, support me, support me. Well, guess what? When the homework, when the book bag, when he walks in your classroom, you need to support me. And it was never being done. I can't tell you how many times I walked into the classroom, dumped the desk over, and there's all the homework shoved in the back. And I looked right at the principal. I'm like, this is unacceptable. This is absolutely ridiculous. Or I'd find it like, you know, in the cubby, or I'd find it in the, you know, it depends what they had in the classroom. Sometimes teachers had closets and stuff like that. And it was always blamed on him and blamed on me. So I didn't play the blame game, even though it's really the teacher's fault and the principal's fault for the way they run their classrooms. I just had to solve the problem. So there's a whole thing about homework, homework bins, which I learned from a special education teacher, by the way. The homework bin solution is amazing. We talk about bins, binders, homework, homework bins. We talk about the system set and play, homework assignment books. They don't even do those, right? We talked about that. and we talk about transitioning from subject to subject within the classroom. Sometimes when they get into these, they have to transition to these specials. Sometimes when they're middle school, they have to transition to their classes, English to math. We talk about all of that. And then we talk about lockers. That's another area. So if you never taught the child the skills of getting the homework, you know, home and back, they're going to have a problem with lockers, because lockers are like a black hole. So we talk about lockers and a great system that my friend, who's a social worker, and she did with her kids. Amazing. So there's a couple different ways you can do the locker and set it up so they it's easy for them. We talk about seating. We go back to seating. We talk about quiet tennis balls and yoga balls and all that stuff. Fire drills, bells and whistles and things like that. My son had anxiety attacks over fire drills, so there's a solution here. Graphic organizers should be used on all things. Rubrics should be used, and teachers don't use them. And then they yell at you if the child didn't do the project correctly. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Boards are great for what's going to happen next. The actual multitasking of creating a report can be really, really hard. So rubrics and graphic organizers and boards really, really help there. We go over that. And then the reward systems, which I talk about, the tokens, the tickets, the points, the more, which ones don't work, which ones are you're just really ruining your classroom, and which ones are going to really help your classroom. Rules, consequence, and punishments. That's a really big thing about the reward system that you need to read about, because if you're doing it wrong, you're just going to be in this vicious circle and never overcome the problem. Fine motor skills, gross motor skills, handwriting problems, And we talk about math madness because this was an area for my son that they just assume kids that are really smart are math smart. That's not the case, because math isn't really just about being smart. Really, this is a system I couldn't stand. This was an area I couldn't stand. I know I'm going over, but I just want to throw some of these at you so you know what the book's about. But there's also something with math that, like, it's also about staying in lines, right? So you're thinking numbers, you have to organize your thoughts to your hand and the paper, and then you have to do spatial concept of thinking. Math requires a lot of multitasking, and it's a lot of that frontal brain. So you could be smart, but it might just even be the paper, the columns, while crossing out and carrying over and subtracting and all that stuff. So you really have to look at math. Some teachers get 40 math problems at home, and they're the same concept. It's stupid. Like, if they're getting the concept, you don't need to do 40 problems. So that's another thing. Can you cut down the break it down? Can you use real money? Can you play board games on the younger kids? Patterns, bowling, we do bowling pins, hopscotch boxes for math, flashcards, computers, multi-sensory math is really, really where kids learn. And if you have younger kids, you can make this so much fun. If you're using rote dittos with young kids, I'm challenging you to really find some teachers who have nailed this, because math, I think kids could really do well if it was more multi-sensory. Gross motor skills, we talk about that. That's a problem. Kids get punished. Kids get bullied in this area, because gym class, a nightmare. Absolute nightmare, you gym teachers. Really, when you have kids that don't have gross motor skills, they shouldn't be treated the way some of the things that I've witnessed over 10 years. It's just sad. So you could read about that. We talk about anxiety in general, all the things you can do to help with anxiety. Social skills. This is just sad that I even have to bring this up. The bullying and the things that go on in school. I talk about that and how I feel that should be handled today. It shouldn't even be exist. That's why I'll tell you, but it's not being addressed. It's not being addressed. The locker rooms is another area of fear. So we talk about getting changed, that if your child's going over that, oral presentations and group projects. I'm going to end this for you, so it's not so long. Sing, play. I have a section on dare to draw, sing, or play. So I challenge you on that. We actually have a section on driving, even though that's high school, and autonomy, because now I get into the older years in the back, some of these new things we added. Your ultimate goal is to have your child be autonomous and not have to depend on you. And how do you get them in to be, once you get to high school, can't keep doing everything for them. And you actually can't expect the IEP to do everything for them. So there's a little bit of a transitioning here now where we're not going to expect the entire school system to really, you know, bend for them. And because when they get off to college, or if they get a job, it's not going to bend as much. So we talk about that transition of letting the child figure this out for themselves, and let's pull some things away. And, you know, we talk about even, you know, chores at home and bills starting to be paid and how to make that huge in transition and try to help you. And then my last part of the book is talking about accountability for also. I'm challenging everyone in the school system involved, from the superintendent all the way down. And then the last is my favorite part of the book, where it's an interview with Luke. I guess probably the book came out 10 years ago, but I probably wrote it. It probably took me 2 years to write. So this might be 12 years ago, but it's really, really good to get into the mind of a child and how they feel about how they're being treated and how they feel, how they see it. And I really, really, love this book. You'll understand how your child's disability impedes academic and social success in the classroom. And as a result, you'll learn how to implement adaptive strategies that will allow your child to shine. So grab some tea and dive on into my book. It's time to create a sensational classroom for your child. And if it's your grandchild or your niece or nephew or one of your patients or a neighbor, please tell them about The Over-Tilted Child. It's the name of my book, and it's called Creating Sensational Classrooms for Children with Sensory Processing Disorder, Autism Spectrum Disorders, and ADD and ADHD. Thank you.